I'm Philip Drew, and this is going to be the weekend interview show here in a little while. This is my disc of Oklahoma City bombing clips, and we're going to start here with a speech given by our current chief executive, George W. Bush, directly after the execution of Timothy McVeigh.
The victims of the Oklahoma City bombing have been given not vengeance, but justice. Due process ruled. The case was proved. The verdict was calmly reached. And the rights of the accused were protected and observed to the full and to the end. Under the laws of our country, the matter is concluded. Life and history bring tragedies, and often they cannot be explained.
Okay, now, this audio is from a meeting that was taking place, I believe, at the courthouse across the street from the Alfred P. Murrah Building on the morning that it was bombed. And this is a tape recorder that was playing, I guess, in somebody's pocket or in their briefcase or something. And you're going to hear a lot of noise here. Pay attention to the very beginning. You'll hear four distinct blasts, and then there's a lot of feedback and whatever as the tape recorders bouncing around. That's not to be interpreted as more bombs, but you can definitely hear at the very beginning, pow, 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 pow. So, any case, George Bush says the matter is concluded. I'm not so sure.
With regard to this proceeding, basically, there are four elements that I have to receive information regarding.
CBS News poll out this morning finds 53% of Americans believe questions about what happened in Oklahoma City will continue.
Based on a sketch of two men believed to be the bombers. One sketch showed a dead ringer for Timothy McVeigh, but John Doe number two, according to the FBI, turned out not to exist. So authorities focused their attention on Timothy McVeigh, who was charged with the crime just 2 days after the bombing.
McVeigh was stopped just 75 minutes after the explosion for driving a car without license plates and arrested for carrying a concealed weapon.
Kathy,
Okay, now this is Kathy Wilburn. Her two grandchildren, Chase and Colton Smith, died in the Oklahoma City bombing. And this is an interview of her on Good Morning America by Charles Gibson on the morning of McVeigh's execution. This is directly after McVeigh was executed.
Kathy, I know you have been so concerned about this execution because you've spent the recent years of your life looking into whether or not there was a conspiracy that was larger than just McVeigh, Terry Nichols, and a couple of others. Do you feel any differently now having seen this or having gone through the execution this morning?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, this was just a bump in the road on... Just a bump in the road to me. I feel absolutely no different. There absolutely were other people involved in the Oklahoma City bombing, and I've been working with MGA Films the last 2 years, and we're going to be releasing a documentary entitled A Cry for Justice, The Untold Story, and I think the American people are going to be surprised at what they're going to see.
Hear, hear to that, and I think you'll also be surprised at what you hear next. And from Charles Key later on today, I'm going to go ahead and play a whole little montage here of assorted news clips from the local news channels in Oklahoma City. That's Channel 4, Channel 5, Channel 8, and Channel 9, including some of these clips being simultaneously broadcast nationwide and worldwide by CNN. And so I'm going to just go ahead and let that roll for a minute. This is news clips from the morning of the Oklahoma City bombing.
Oh my God, another bomb.
I
Mike, let's take a look now, if we could. I understand we just received videotape in a news conference held just a few moments ago at St. Anthony's Hospital.
Okay. This is Tom Coniglione. He's medical director of St. Anthony Hospital. This is Jim Maravich. He is chief operating officer and executive vice president of the hospital. I'll give you their cards after the conference is over so you'll know the spelling.
Doctor, can you tell us the situation?
The situation at the present time is that we have treated more than 56 injuries. There have been several more since last count. At the present time, the medical teams downtown are unable to get into the wreckage to retrieve more of the injured because of the presence of other bombs in the area. I've been told by the police department that just as soon as those bombs are defused, they will permit the medical teams to enter. And once the medical teams enter, we expect quite a large number of rather badly injured individuals being brought here.
Update our audience that the Justice Department is reporting that a second explosive device has been found in the AP Mura building in downtown Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. Mike, you're still with us, aren't you?
Yes, I am. And I might tell you in addition to that that, in fact, what we were told at the scene a few minutes ago was that, in fact, two different explosive devices were found in addition to the one that went off.
So a total of three.
A total of three. And, of course, then there was mass confusion whenever there were hundreds of spectators in the area, and when they heard that there were other bombs in the building, people were running from the area in the opposite direction as fast as they could, trying to evacuate again.
So if you weren't under that desk, you wouldn't have made it.
Well, my floor was okay, and the ceiling had come down, but there was still concrete above, so it was just a corner of the office that was left that we were in. Everybody else that we worked with is gone.
Are you okay? Just the corner of your office was okay, and the rest of the floor was completely flattened?
We could go over the edge and look, and you could see the sky and as far down as you can look, and just a hole.
And which floor were you on?
Fifth.
On fifth?
Fifth floor.
Just the one corner of the fifth floor wasn't completely flattened.
I don't know what the building looks like.
Everybody just crawled out of the desk after?
It was like slow motion. We crawled under before the glass started coming, and everything it just seemed to roll in on us. I thought it was an earthquake when it started. It was just a kind of a shake, and then everything started going like this, and I dove under the desk, and then all the glass came in, and the ceilings came down. I probably got cut worse if I hadn't been under the desk. I just got little scrapes and scratches. I was really lucky.
Okay, so this guy was from California. When he felt the building begin to shake, he thought it was an earthquake. That's what he's used to, you know, when buildings shake, you dive under the desk. Well, he dove under the desk, and it saved him from all the flying glass. Now, you would imagine that if a truck bomb was solely responsible for the damage to the building, that the first thing to happen to anyone would be that they would be cut to ribbons by flying glass. And yet, somehow, this guy, his name is Jack, in fact, he's a friend of VZ Lawton, who I've interviewed on this show, archive at philipdrew.com, and he dove under the desk and was protected from all the flying glass. And in fact, that same story goes for VZ Lawton, who when the building started shaking, something fell on his head and knocked him out, and he happened to fall behind a desk which protected him from the flying glass. So, for those of you who aren't idiots, the building was shaking before the truck bomb went off. There were multiple bombs inside the building, and of course you already heard about the bombs inside the building that did not go off. And in fact, were removed by the local bomb squad. Here's some more clips of that.
Now, we're also hearing from some witnesses on the scene that they've overheard from firefighters that were first on the scene that there was a possibility that there was a secondary explosive device besides the car bomb device outside the building, and that that device may have been placed near the nursery.
See the sheriff's bomb squad. These people are obviously very, very busy today. They just pulled up. They're continuing to stay in the area, and as we have more information, we'll bring it to you. Back to you guys.
Freedom is the freedom to say 2 + 2 = 4. How many fingers am I holding up, miss?
Four.
And if the boss says there are not four, but five, then how many?
Five. Balut here joining me. Dave, what do you have to add?
Well, I just took a look down the street at the Morrow building again. I see another bomb truck going, so apparently they're going to try to get out that third bomb that's been talked about. Still a lot of activity around the Morrow building. Security concerns that another one still might go off. That's what everybody's worried about.
That's the reason they have moved the media. Everyone's back.
Well, I just took a look down the street at the Morrow building again. I see another bomb truck going, so apparently they're going to try to get out that third bomb that's been talked about.
Evacuating. John, can you tell me? They have found...
Bomb
squad is there, west corner of the Morrow building. Is that correct? Another bomb inside the Morrow building.
Supposedly there may be another device there.
There may be another device there, and they are evacuating the area.
And we'll reiterate again what these later devices are doing to the rescue effort. Time is so valuable right now as they try to get to these people who perhaps somehow are still hanging on to life inside that building. And each delay, every time the firefighters and the rescuers are caught to are called back and brought back down off of their ladders and scaffoldings, just could be exacting a terrible, terrible toll on the people who are already inside.
Yes, it is. And we talked earlier about the two undetonated bombs that were found that were bigger than the device that exploded. And if this other one that they're looking at now turns out to be something, it appears that it was meant for this building to come down, to be leveled.
At the present time, the medical teams downtown are unable to get into the wreckage to retrieve more of the injured because of the presence of other bombs in the area. I've been told by the police department that just as soon as those bombs are defused, they will permit the medical teams to enter.
Right now, they are saying that this is the work of a sophisticated group. This is a very sophisticated device, and it has to have been done by an explosives expert, obviously, with this type of explosion.
The Justice Department is reporting that a second explosive device has been found in the A.P. Mora building in downtown Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm. Two other explosive devices were found that were not detonated, and they were larger than the first. But there were more bombs set to go off, according to ATF officials.
That we have here, you can see the sheriff's bomb squad. These people are obviously very, very busy today. They've just pulled up. They're continuing to stay in the area. And as we have more information, we'll bring it to you. Back to you guys.
Okay, my friends, so there you have the firefighters, the local police department, the FBI, the ATF, and the Department of Justice all confirming the presence of multiple bombs. Two, at least, that did not go off, that were removed by local authorities.
All right. We just saw, if you were watching there, there was a white pickup truck backing a trailer into the scene here. They're trying to move people out of the way so they can get it in. It appears to be the Oklahoma County Bomb Squad. If their bomb disposal unit essentially is what it is, and it is what they would use to, if the report that we gave you just a few moments ago turns out to be correct, that they have found a second explosive device of some kind inside this building, they'll back that trailer down there, and the bomb squad folks will go in, and they will use that that trailer. You see the bucket on the back there, sort of, this is how they would transport the explosive device away from this populated area to try to do something with it.
If you are outside the metro area, you'd have to be well outside the metro area if you did not feel the blast that occurred.
This was just a few moments ago.
People running north away from the federal building.
But there were more bombs set to go off, according to ATF officials.
It's been about 5 hours now since that first explosion occurred, almost 5 hours exactly. You probably, if you were in bed at the time that it rattled you around, you looked at the alarm clock, you'll remember the time, and you will certainly now remember April 19th, 1995. But 5 hours since, and because of these renewed concerns about new devices, 5 hours in, they are still really not able to get the rescue effort into full swing.
Okay, now here's the good part, folks. This is 4 hours later. This is from Channel 4 News in Oklahoma City. And this is where the story changes. We've been talking, he says, he begins this clip with, it's been 5 hours since the bombing, and we've been talking this entire 5 hours about multiple bombs inside the building, but oh, I'm reading it right off the wire here. Turns out the ATF now says it was a car bomb with 1,200 pounds of explosives parked out front, and it's funny the way The newscaster says 1,200. He's looking at this massive building cut almost in half, the entire face of it gone, eight columns collapsed, and he's thinking to himself, a car bomb with 1,200 pounds of explosives? Well, that must have been a big 100, and so he says 100 in the biggest way he can think of, and, you know, that's just cognitive dissonance. I'm not saying that the newscaster is deliberately lying, but he's reading it right off the wire, so it must be true, so now he's trying to adjust his brain to the new fact, as according to the wire. That should be fun. And then they interview Randall Heather, the terrorism expert, and apparently he hasn't gotten the change in story yet. He doesn't know that we're talking about a car bomb out front now. He's still talking about bombs inside the building, so I think this is funny. This is the point in the story where the bombs move from inside the building and multiple to one parked outside.
Devin, we're getting more word of a car bomb now. Let's read this straight from the wire. You talked about it a minute ago. The head of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms now says it appears it was a car bomb with as much as 1,200 pounds of explosives packed inside. 1,200 pounds of explosives packed inside that car bomb in front of the federal building. We heard earlier off the wire that from the governor that some of the fatalities were outside and across the street from the building. Now it all makes sense because the bomb was parked outside in a car. Should we be shocked about a car bomb in Oklahoma City?
Well, any place you have a federal building, you have a target.
Well, that's the question everybody has right now. Why here? Why Oklahoma City?
You find out by finding why that building. I don't think it's material that it was in Oklahoma City. It's really the building. The building could have been in any city in the United States. The question is, why that building? And was it Waco? Is it Nation of Islam? We should find out an awful lot when the bombs are taken apart. I think it was a great stroke of luck. As you were mentioning, it's hard to talk about luck on a day like today in Oklahoma City, but it was a great stroke of luck that we actually have got diffused bombs. It's through the bomb material that we will be able to track down who committed this atrocity.
Ladies and gentlemen, the governor of Oklahoma, Frank Keating.
The reports I have is that one device was deactivated. Apparently there's another device, and obviously whatever did the damage to the Murrah building was a tremendous, very sophisticated explosive.
Rescue worker Tony Garrett.
There was a period when we were bringing the bodies to the playground, and that's when we had noticed that we needed to evacuate the building because there was another bomb. They had found another bomb. There was at least four other people that had told me that there was a bomb in front of the building.
And these four other people, were they part of the rescue effort?
Yes.
All
and there was a couple of people that had actually seen them remove the bomb when the bomb squad had come down to the Murrah building.
Would you describe what they said that this particular bomb looked like?
They really didn't go into detail.
I
didn't ask for details because I wouldn't have known what they meant.
Did you say something to me on the initial interview that these people said that there was a timing device or something?
There was a timing device on one of the bomb that they had secured earlier that morning that had been set to go 10 minutes after the bombs had gone off that morning, which they assumed that the mechanism of the bomb malfunctioned because of the blast. So that's what caused that bomb not to explode.
I see. Did this person tell you it was definitely an active bomb, or did any of these people tell you it was actually definitely an active bomb?
Yes.
They did. So then they defused the bomb. Is that basically what they did? I guess the bomb squad did that.
The bomb squad took it off.
That was Tony Garrett. Now Edie Smith, the daughter of Kathy Wilburn, mother of Chase and Colton Smith, wondering, how come ATF wasn't in the building when it blew up?
We asked some simple questions and we can't get any answers, so it makes us that much more curious, you know? Where the hell were they?
Channel 4 News.
Agents forewarned about a bomb in Oklahoma City. Did they know the Murrah building was a target? The ATF says no, absolutely not. But tonight in the story you'll see only on the news channel, You're about to hear otherwise from people who were at the Murrah building that morning.
We asked some simple questions and we can't get any answers, so it makes us that much more curious, you know. Where the hell were they?
The news channel did ask for a private meeting with ATF officials to discuss the credibility of these witness reports, but the ATF refused, saying they had no more to say on the subject.
What he told him is that he thought that they had received a tip that morning of the bomb.
Yet another witness, a rescue worker, says after she talked with an agent at the bombing scene, she also suspected the ATF was warned and agents stayed away from their office that morning.
I asked him if his office was in the building, and he said yes, and I asked if there were any ATF agents that were still in the building, and he said no, we weren't here.
Witness number one approached an ATF agent nearby. He claims he asked the agent what had happened, and witness number one says this is what the agent told him.
He started getting a little bit nervous. He tried reaching somebody on a two-way radio. Couldn't get anybody, and I told him I wanted an answer right then. He said they were in the briefing. None of the agents had been in there. They had been tipped by their pagers not to come into work that day. Plain as day out of his mouth. They were tipped. Why wasn't anybody else? There was a lot of people, good people, died down there. And if they knew, they should have let everybody else know.
And looking out my window in the afternoon, it's about between 1:30 and 2 o'clock, I noticed a large gathering of people outside the building. That was about 200 to 300 people. And
the day before,
when I looked at these folks, I said, well, Mike, what could be going on with the federal building?
Did you think that this could have been a bomb threat or a fire drill?
Initially, there was several questions came to my mind what it could have been, but at that time, like I said, I had no idea.
Did you notice any extra precautions being taken at the federal building during the week on or before the day of the bombing?
An interesting observation I did notice, on the morning of the bomb explosion, the TV networks locally were carrying the statement that the federal building had received a bomb threat 1 week prior to that morning of the bomb explosion. So, in my mind, when I heard that, I'm saying, well, what I observed 1 week earlier out my window, could that... And then the next question came, if so, what security precautions had been taken if they knew this?
And here's some more from Channel 4 News about John Doe 2 and the 22 different video cameras that recorded the destruction of the Murrah building that have never been seen by anyone outside of government.
When I seen McVeigh was with another person.
Do you have any doubt in your mind that there was a passenger in the water truck?
That's even more. I have no doubt. There was definitely a second person, no matter what. There was two people in this vehicle.
John Doe number two, and there was a $2 million price put on his head. And now they're saying there's no John Doe number two.
And our witnesses picked out a photo lineup. The news channel shared the information and surveillance tapes of this man with the FBI. They've had some of that material long before our reports went on the air.
In the building, and I was looked out the window, and I seen a driver's truck, and I seen a man get out of the driver's truck.
She was just 10 feet away from the man depicted in this sketch when he stepped out of the Ryder truck.
He was olive complexion, and he was... He had black curly hair. He was wearing the baseball cap, but his curls were sticking out of his head. He was short in the back, but you could still see the curls in his hair. He was not American. He was foreign. You can tell by his skin, his face.
We asked if Dan Vogel, if John Doe number two is still part of the investigation. Does he exist? The answer, yes. The FBI is still trying to locate and identify John Doe number two. The man in our reports is Iraqi. Today, the FBI says they are not pursuing a Middle Eastern connection. This doesn't mean it has been ruled out. That could change tomorrow.
But John Doe number two, according to the FBI, turned out not to exist.
And the details are chilling. We'll also focus on surveillance cameras that caught the bombing on tape, and maybe the men behind the bombing. The news channel has new information tonight that there's a chance surveillance tapes could be the smoking gun evidence. Now, we asked candid questions in a rare face-to-face meeting with ATF officials close to the investigation. We learned that video collected from downtown businesses the morning of April 19th may someday be played before a jury. Officials won't say who or what exactly is on the tape. However, numerous sources have confirmed the tapes exist and that they reveal more than one bomber.
So what evidence are they asking for? They're asking for video taken from the Ryder trucks from the Rigi Towers.
Well, Kevin, it's a question we've all been asking. We've been asking that question since we first broke the story that surveillance cameras aimed at the federal building could have captured all those involved on tape. Now, sources have confirmed those tapes exist and that they show more than one bomber. The FBI also confirmed those tapes exist when they refused to release them, claiming the video is part of a criminal investigation. And now, for the first time, we get an on-the-record response from the head of the Dallas office, ATF. We learn that videotape could be unveiled as part of the prosecution's case. No officials will discuss specifically what's on the video, but we have been able to recreate some of what may have been captured by downtown surveillance cameras through the eyes of the witnesses.
That video was never used at the trial, and I correct my earlier statement that nobody outside of government ever saw it. Somebody from the L.A. Times did, and somebody, I don't know if it was from Channel 4 or they just met with the L.A. Times folks, but their claim to this news station that, well, we can't show you the video now because it's an investigation in progress, but we'll use the video at the trial, they didn't. In fact, the only video that they used at the trial was a still frame from a camera that was on the same side of the street as the Murrah building and down the street further where the truck supposedly stopped for the fuse to be lit, although it's just one still frame and you don't see anybody stopping or lighting a fuse or anything. It's just a still frame of a Ryder truck on the street and you can't even see McVeigh in it. So that's the only footage that they ever used at McVeigh's trial. They never did show any of the 22 different angles that they had recorded the destruction of the Murrah building from. Pardon me, Channel 4 News in Oklahoma continues.
Looking at a computer recreation of the final movements of the Ryder truck according to the people who crossed its path at 5th and Harvey, moments before the explosion. Tonight at 10, the witnesses will detail their memories of how they believe the suspects carried out the crime and made their getaway. Now, all these accounts share a common and unsettling similarity. The witnesses say they saw several accomplices, including the infamous John Doe number 2. ATF officials tell us the elusive John Doe is still part of this case, but will not comment any further. However, they did tell us that there's a lot about this case we don't know yet. Information you can't find in the indictments against Timothy McVeigh, Terry Nichols, and Michael Fortier.
It was just hours after the bombing when the news channel first told you about the possibility that surveillance cameras may have captured the explosion and the killers on tape. Our sources and sources for the L.A. Times describe what's actually on those tapes. The information shows some huge surprises, the biggest that it may have been John Doe number 2, not Timothy McVeigh, who detonated the bomb. Brad Edwards has the latest on the investigation in this exclusive News Channel report.
Our new information comes directly from a source that has seen parts of those surveillance tapes. It also comes from reports now in the Los Angeles Times, but perhaps the biggest surprise is contained in the news channel's own information.
Timothy McVeigh was not the last person to leave the Ryder truck. In fact, another man sat inside the cab of the truck after McVeigh got out. We believe that man is John Doe number 2, a man who, for all we know, is still on the loose, leaving open a vital question. Was it John Doe number 2 who actually set off the bomb, not Timothy McVeigh, as we've all been led to believe? News Channel 4 has for weeks been demanding copies of the surveillance tapes from the FBI. The federal government so far is dragging its feet. But many people in the investigation have seen the tapes, and now so has a source willing to describe to the news channel what the tapes show. The L.A. Times report shows there was a surveillance camera near the corner of 5th and Harvey and another near the corner of 5th and Robinson. Federal investigators recreated the time sequence leading up to the bombing by matching the video and still photos from the surveillance cameras.
Since we can't show you the tape ourselves, we're reenacting what our source says he saw on those tapes.
As witnesses told the news channel before, the tapes show the Ryder truck parked in front of the Murrah building where we now know the blast went off. As witnesses also told us, the tape showed two men sitting inside the Ryder truck. A man strongly resembling Timothy McVeigh gets out of the driver's side, steps down. He then appears to have dropped something on the step up into the truck. He bends down and appears to pick something up off the step. Then he turns and walks directly across Fifth Street toward the Journal Record building. All this time, John Doe number 2 is still inside the Ryder truck's cab, sitting on the passenger side. Time passes. The surveillance tape is time-lapse photography. Without knowing exactly the time interval between shots, our source can't be sure how long John Doe number 2 sat in that cab. What was he doing all that time? Then the tape shows John Doe number 2 getting out of the passenger side of the Ryder truck. Again, the tape shows that a bombing witness accurately described what happened next to News Channel 4.
I was standing in the building, and I looked out the window, and I seen the Ryder truck, and I seen a man get out of the Ryder truck.
The tape shows John Doe number 2 getting out, shutting the passenger side door. He steps toward the front of the truck and is momentarily out of the frame of the surveillance camera. But shortly, he appears back in frame, walking toward the rear of the truck, still on the sidewalk in front of the Murrah building. Again, he turns east toward the front of the truck, looking toward the street. John Doe number 2 then walks diagonally across Fifth Street toward the east, as if heading toward the YMCA or the intersection of 5th and Robinson. He again leaves the frame of the camera. Another camera shooting from another angle clearly shows the actual explosion that destroyed the federal building and killed 169 people. So what does the mysterious John Doe number 2 look like in the tapes? The man who stayed inside the Ryder truck, possibly triggering the bomb? Well, his features are obscured by a baseball cap in the portion of tape seen by our source, the same kind of cap shown in the composite drawing first released of John Doe number 2. The cap was a sports cap, flame style. The man himself was taller than the man resembling McVeigh and much thicker in build. He appears to have a dark or olive complexion. Our source saw only a few minutes of tape. He didn't see all of the almost 20 minutes of surveillance tapes that reportedly were distributed to FBI agents around the country to help in their investigation. But they do show enough to raise some crucial questions. Who actually set off the bomb? What was John Doe number 2 doing in the cab of the truck after the McVeigh lookalike got out? And how did John Doe number 2 get away from the Murrah building?
My understanding is there was a video of McVeigh getting out of the Ryder truck, jumping into this other pickup with John Doe number 2. Where's that video? Are we ever going to get to see it?
A search of witness Terry Nichols' home in Harrington, Kansas, turned up a receipt for nearly a ton of the type fertilizer used to make the bomb. And Tim McVeigh's fingerprints were found on the receipt.
Which sounds very incriminating, except that the only reason that they know that it was a fertilizer bomb was the fertilizer and the receipt. So you see, it's a vicious circle. How do you know that Terry Nichols is guilty? Well, because he bought all this fertilizer. And we got McVeigh's thumbprint on the receipt for it. Oh, that's very interesting. And how do you know it was a fertilizer bomb? Well, we found some fertilizer and a receipt with McVeigh's thumbprint on it at Terry Nichols' house. Oh, okay, so you're telling me that you have not a single molecule of forensic evidence to indicate that an ammonium nitrate fuel oil bomb was used in Oklahoma that day? That's right. We have the receipt.
Right away, the defense took the jury to the Dreamland Motel, where McVeigh stayed before the bombing. Two witnesses say they saw a Ryder truck here on Easter Sunday. That's important because the bomb truck wasn't rented until the next day, Monday. Then the defense called Jeff Davis, who says he delivered food to McVeigh's Dreamland room, but the man inside wasn't McVeigh.
Let me say, first of all, what I have done today.
Now, this is William Jefferson Clinton's response to the Oklahoma City bombing on 60 Minutes.
Let me say, first of all, what I have done today. I've renewed my call in the Congress to pass the anti-terrorism legislation that's up there that I've sent. I have determined to send some more legislation to the Hill that will strengthen the hand of the FBI and other law enforcement officers in cracking terrorist networks, both domestic and foreign. I have instructed the federal government to do a preventive effort on all federal buildings that we have today, and we're going to rebuild Oklahoma City. Now, over and above that, I have asked the Attorney General, the FBI Director, and the National Security Advisor to give me a set of things which can go into a directive about what else we should do. I don't want to prejudge this issue. But the nations of this world are going to have to get together, bring our best minds together, and figure out what to do about this.
Yeah, great job, Bill. Like, turn down Sudan's 5 offers to turn over bin Laden to us, is that what you mean, the global war on terrorism? And imagine that. I mean, just think about that for a minute. You know, all this in the news lately about failures to prevent September 11th. Here's Bill Clinton after Oklahoma City, which supposedly was done by 2 right-wing, redneck, white guys with guns. And Bill already is saying, hey, this is, we got to get together with the leaders of the world to figure out what we're going to do about this. Oh, yeah, and pass some new laws, too. Now, this is my favorite, and for anybody who's getting bored silly or is crying because they're so depressed about how easy it is to fool the American people, this ought to be a little bit of comic relief for you. This is Ed Bradley from 60 Minutes, that renowned journalist. I edited out all McVeigh's answers. This is the questions that Ed Bradley asked Timothy McVeigh less than a year, I think, before the execution. In fact, I think less than 6 months before the execution. This is Ed Bradley's interview of Timothy McVeigh, y'all.
With 168 people killed in the blast, the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City 3 years ago was the most heinous crime in United States history. Tonight, Timothy McVeigh speaks publicly for the first time since he was convicted and sentenced to death for setting the explosion.
What was your reaction when you saw those pictures? What was that like for you that day? People were shouting at you. I remember somebody had shouted out, baby killer. Did you ever talk to Kaczynski?
I did.
Do you think that you and he share similar concerns about how the government operates these days? In your high school yearbook, you, under future plans, you wrote, and I'm quoting here,
okay,
take it as it comes, buy a Lamborghini, California girls. Let me ask you your opinion, just a snapshot opinion of some of the institutions in this country and some officials in this country. ATF, for example, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau. The IRS? FBI? What do you think of the Attorney General, Jan Arena? President Clinton? Tell me what it is about that shootout at Ruby Ridge that concerns you. There are a lot of people who are upset by that, who would say, yeah, what happened there is wrong, but those are isolated incidents. That was just Ruby Ridge and Waco. What would you say to that?
I would say I don't necessarily believe that to be true. I think for people that follow the news and follow events, there are patterns of abuse evident.
And according to Timothy McVeigh, it is up to the citizens of the United States to keep their government in check.
Okay, now you understand what's going on there. Ed Bradley and Timothy McVeigh both have a great opportunity during this interview. For Ed Bradley, it's his great opportunity to try to conflate in the minds of the American people Timothy McVeigh with anyone else who thinks that perhaps Waco and Ruby Ridge weren't isolated incidents. And the idea that it's the responsibility of the people to make the government obey the law? Why, yeah, you and Timothy McVeigh think that, buddy. I hope you don't have a bomb in your trunk. And, of course, it's Timothy McVeigh's opportunity to sound like a reasonable guy. Oh, no, I'm not a psycho Nazi who's put in this truck to drive this bomb to help kill all these people. I'm a reasonable guy. I think that Waco was a bad thing. And so if you think Waco was a bad thing, then you agree with Timothy McVeigh. And it worked out great for Ed Bradley and not so well for McVeigh. But, you know, that's been part of the Nichols trial this week, is that they found anti-government books at his house. Well, my goodness, anti-government books. And from that very same 60 Minutes, this is a clip of one of the jurors. They brought together the jurors in the McVeigh case, and I don't know if you guys remember, but, you know, right before he was executed, they came up with all these documents that somehow they had mistakenly misplaced. And so they're asking, Ed Bradley asked this jury, you know, how are you guys so sure that he did it? I mean, you know, did they really prove the case really good? And this is the way the juror answered, that he was guilty unless he could prove otherwise, that the burden of proof was on the defendant to prove that he did not do it. She did not cite credible evidence by the prosecution that McVeigh was responsible and most responsible for the bombing. She just simply says, since nobody came forward to give him a good alibi, then he must be the guy. And that's on the basis that she convicted him. Now, don't anybody misunderstand me. I'm not sitting here arguing Timothy McVeigh's innocence, because I believe that he was very, very much, in fact, involved in the Oklahoma bombing. At least he drove the truck there. I'm not sure what other role he had in it. But at the very least, the guy was guilty and deserved to die for his role in the bombing. I'm not saying that. I'm just pointing out that the prosecution did such a flimsy job of proving their case that the jurors, knowing that they had to convict, because, hey, after all, we all know this is the guy. So in order to go ahead and convict, they had to put all of the burden of proof on the defendant.
I'm sure that there would be someone who would step forward with an alibi. I was waiting for the day that someone said, hey, wait a minute, I saw him here, there, or wherever. And it never happened.
Timothy McVeigh's trial included hours of wrenching testimony from victims describing the carnage after the explosion.
I mean, you realize that most people in this country think you're responsible for the bombing, correct?
Correct.
Right? So if your perception is that you didn't get a fair trial, they're saying, so what?
According to Timothy McVeigh, it is up to the citizens of the United States to keep their government in check.
This is a clip of Nikki Deutschman. She was the foreperson of the Terry Nichols jury at the federal level that convicted him of involuntary manslaughter. And for those that don't know, the original vote among that jury was 10-2 to acquit Terry Nichols. Again, I'm not saying he's innocent. In fact, I believe that he was probably even more involved in this plot than Timothy McVeigh was, and was probably, in fact, guilty as hell. The problem is the government couldn't really do their job proving that that was the case without incriminating themselves. Oops. And so they just put on a bare-bones case against Nichols, and they barely got a conviction at all. As I said, the original vote was 10-2 to acquit, and it was in the newspaper quotes from one of the two that voted to convict in the first place, and he said, we made them cry. Me and my buddy, who also agreed that he ought to be convicted, we berated the rest of the jurors and made them cry until they agreed to compromise and find him guilty of involuntary manslaughter. And then he got life for an involuntary manslaughter charge. And again, I'm not saying he's not guilty. I'm just saying that the prosecution didn't prove their case. And this is a quote from Nikki Deutschman, the foreperson of that jury.
The government didn't do a good job of proving that Terry Nichols was greatly involved in all of this.
And if you want at least the direction of the evidence which would prove Terry Nichols' involvement in this case, you need to look to all of his trips to the Philippines and his associations with the Al-Qaeda splinter group Abu Sayyaf, and the his association with Abdul Hakim Murad and Ramzi Youssef, both of whom are now sitting in federal prison for life for their participation in the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993. And if you want to read more about that special case, you should read the October 28, 1993 New York Times. It has some very interesting things for you on the front page. And in fact, I've since heard an interview with the author of that story where he restates that he still stands by that. But that's a different story. I don't want to get all into that, except that this splinter subset of Al-Qaeda had been operating since really we were done stabbing them in the back in 89. In Afghanistan, and pulling out all our stuff before the Russians pulled out theirs and leaving them high and dry after a lot of big promises. So anyway, they had turned on us almost immediately after that. And I believe it has proven the ties between Osama bin Laden and I believe it's Akeem Murad. Anyway, this is from Frontline. The story they did on Frontline PBS about the death of John O'Neill, the terrorism agent, the head anti-terrorism agent who actually was forced out of the FBI and died on September 11th at the, where he was the head of security at the World Trade Center. Okay, sorry for all that. Here is Frontline about Murad.
There was the story about two of Ramzi Youssef's Bojinka co-conspirators, Wali Khan Amin Shah and Abdul Hakim Murad. In 1995, Murad told a story of Middle Eastern pilots training at U.S. flight schools and of a proposal to dive bomb a jetliner into a federal building. It was a tantalizing bit of information. Agents were dispatched, but then withdrawn. The investigation languished.
And that guy, Abdul Hakim Murad, took credit in 1995, claimed responsibility for the Oklahoma City bombing. And if you don't think that's right, then that's what Google search engines are for. Murad, Oklahoma City bombing. I bet you'll find something. Okay, now, this is a clip from some lawyers who, you know, I never do trust the motivation of lawyers. And I'm not really sure about this. There was Iraqi involvement in the Oklahoma bombing in the person of Husseini al-Hussein or some shit like that. What's his name? Hussein al-Husseini. Sorry, maybe I got it all backwards. But anyway, the idea that he was connected to the government of Saddam Hussein I think is quite thin. But at least this is from Court TV, so you know that this isn't all just tabloids from Great Britain telling me all my silly things here. This is an interview with some lawyers, or with a lawyer, about their lawsuit against Iraq for the Oklahoma bombing.
I'm joined on the phone by Oklahoma City bombing survivor V.Z. Lawton, a plaintiff in the suit against Iraq. Tom Fitton, he's president of Judicial Watch, and they're filing suits on behalf of the Oklahoma City and World Trade Center survivors and former FBI agent Bill Daley. Let me start with V.Z. because we've got to have the premise, V.Z. What's the connection? What proof do you have?
Well, proof that we have is in a suit that we filed. We had a fellow by the name of Ramzi Youssef, who's directly connected to Saddam Hussein, that was forming a terrorist group over in Cebu City in the Philippines.
Okay, we'll just remind everybody that he was the one that supposedly had a meeting with one of Saddam's guys, and we know that he was convicted of the bombing, the World Trade Center bombing, in 1993.
Right.
So what specifically is your link from that back to Timothy McVeigh?
Well, the link that...
I mean, we're going to have to encapsulate this. We don't have the time to sort of go through it in length, so give me your two or three big points.
Well, the terrorist group that he formed in Cebu City was done with a guy named Abdul Hakim Murad. And they were connected with another person, that Edwin DeAngelis, who was actually the leader of the terrorist group in Cebu City. They had a meeting there, and there was five people that were identified by code names only, but they called it Project Bojinka.
Okay. Now, I'll tell you what, I'm going to run over to Tom Fitton because I want to be sure we get this in before the show's over. And Tom,
okay.
you got to give me a couple of big points here.
Well, this Mr. Youssef's partner, Mr. Murad,
yeah,
took credit for the Oklahoma City bombing when it occurred. Iraqi phone numbers were found with Timothy McVeigh when he was arrested. Mr. Nichols, who was over at Cebu City in the Philippines, was there about the same time as Youssef and came back with alarming abilities to build bombs, the abilities he didn't have prior to his Philippine trip. You've got U.S. defense officials quoted in U.S. News report thinking that McVeigh may have been an Iraqi agent. There's lots of information. Interpol, for instance, VZ asked for documents concerning Oklahoma City from Interpol. He got an article back naming Ramzi Youssef in the Trade Center bombing, and obviously Interpol thought there was a connection. And obviously Iraq is a well-known sponsor of state terrorism. Even McVeigh himself was sympathetic to the Iraqi cause. You've got writings out of McVeigh in prison supporting Saddam's regime.
He was over there
the
Desert Storm,
there.
And it all could have been as a result of his own machinations as to how the government was treating him. But let's talk about the FBI's take on this, because this has been debated now for several years. Any evidence, any hard evidence that you've seen?
Well, certainly I can't speak for the FBI, but all I can tell you is that the thought that there'd be some conspiracy theory to be able to hide, destroy, change the evidence in this case, I think is very far field, is that we're looking at agents who are sworn to uphold the laws of this country, and we're talking about literally hundreds of investigators who are involved in this case. So we're talking about some type of conspiracy that embodies this massive group of people who have a lot of things to lose.
Well,
there are actually
two positions. One, that the government is hiding information that in fact there is a connection, which I don't know why they would right now since they're trying to rally us to go to war. And number two, that the inept government, the inept FBI and CIA haven't figured this out yet.
Well, at the time, politically, it was more convenient for Bill Clinton to blame Rush Limbaugh for the bombing than to look overseas. Remember, there were others unknown, and this conspiracy did go wider, according to the U.S. government, than Mr. Nichols, Mr. McVeigh.
Okay, well, I assume then you've tracked down the Iraqi phone numbers found with him.
That's what discovery's for. We expect to hear any day now that Iraq has been served with the lawsuit. When they don't show up, we're going to be seeking default judgment, and later, once we get that, we'll be able to show a judge that we had a great basis for moving forward here. And
well, now you've got to prove up your case in a default judgment anyway.
Right, that's true.
That's true.
And hopefully we'll be able to get discovery to allow us to further solidify what we already believe is a very strong case tying Iraq to Oklahoma.
Okay, well, I don't know where you're going to get that discovery. But in terms of the investigation, Bill, are you comfortable that the various relevant agencies took this apart, looking for that connection?
Yeah, I'm very comfortable, and not having been involved, and I can tell you by knowing people who have been, and knowing the type of people who were, and knowing the different agencies that were involved, is that I don't believe they would have missed something that the U.S. News and World Report or some other reporting agency then, you know, called up. I think what we're seeing here is a lot of information, some of it, you know, historical, some of it probably accurate, and trying to, you know, mesh it in with some other beliefs and people who are looking for some greater conspiracy. And I understand maybe perhaps a need for people and victims and their families to look for something larger, but I don't think here that we
should. It just doesn't seem to be a natural fit, the militia movement of the United States and Iraq.
Well, the fact is McVeigh did have sympathies for the government of Iraq. And look, we got information from an FBI 302 where the FBI...
All right, enough of this crap. Yeah, I can't imagine where neo-Nazis and Arabs would have anything in common at all. Can you guys think of anything? Jews? I don't know. Seems like maybe they got one thing in common, at least, you know. I want to talk a little bit about what I just heard there and what I just played for you guys. I think this guy, this lawyer, is totally barking up the wrong tree as far as connecting Ramzi Youssef to the Iraqi government, to Saddam Hussein's government. The idea that Saddam Hussein was behind the Oklahoma bombing is ridiculous. And the fact of the matter is, the connections, and this lawyer, the way he presented it, made it sound like it's all just as credible as each other. The connections between Terry Nichols, Ramzi Youssef, Ali Hakim Murad are strong. And then the connections between Ramzi Youssef and Ali Hakim Murad and Osama bin Laden are tighter than that. Any connection between any of those terrorists and Iraq has got to be thin to nothing. And in fact, that's the kind of thing you read from Lori Milroy, who is the head conspiracy theorist over at the Project for a New American Century and the neocon group that has been pushing for war with Iraq all this time, and as we're learning in the last week, was hell-bent on a war against Iraq from September 12th on. And in fact, someone came out and corroborated Richard Clark's testimony that when they met with George Bush on, I think it was the 12th or the 13th, that he didn't say Afghanistan, Syria, Iran, or any of that one time. It was Iraq, 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 and talked about nothing else. And, you know, this lady, Lori Milroy, she writes all these books that are, you know, super long and all this detailed documented information to prove that Ramzi Youssef was actually this Iraqi by another name. And that may be true, but that doesn't mean he was working for the Iraqi government. And the fact that her book is endorsed by Richard Pearl and Dick Cheney, et cetera, I think ought to, you know, be the killer on that one. Anyways, folks, I'm starting to worry that perhaps Charles Key is not going to call. I'm going to try to call him again. I'm going to play one little clip here from our 10 years gone, wish he had been good friend, Bill Hicks. And let's see here if I can do this right. Track 52. And by the way, he was talking about, I don't even remember what in this clip. It was not Iraq, or it was not, pardon me, the Oklahoma City bombing. But still, I think it applies.
Because to me, it's a great archetype example of how the totalitarian government who rules this planet partitions out information in such a way that we, the masses, are forced to base our conclusions on erroneous. Oh, I'm sorry, wrong meeting. I thought this was the meeting at the docks, no? Oh, shit, that's tomorrow night. All right.
This is Radio KAOS 95.9 FM, Texas. KAOS 959.com. Worldwide.
Well, you wonder why I always dress in black. Why you never see bright colors on my back. And why does my appearance seem to have a somber tone? Well, there's a reason for the things that I have on. I wear the black for the poor and the beaten down. Living in the hopeless, hungry side of town. I wear it for the prisoner who has long paid for his crime, but is there because he's a victim of the times. I wear the black for those who've never read